Follow The Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to our episodes early and ad-free and get access to monthly exclusive episodes. Go to patreon.com/madnesspod. We've got links in our show notes.
The opinions expressed in the following episode do not necessarily reflect those of the Minds of Madness podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
The classic 1942 film Casablanca is often called the most quotable movie of all time, and it's easy to see why. Here's looking at you, kid. We'll always have Paris. This looks like the beginning of a beautiful friendship. Humphrey Bogart delivers every line with his signature staccato perfection, but there's one particular line from the movie that's always stuck with me. One that never really gets the credit it deserves. Bogart's character Rick is approached by a shady black market businessman, and seeing that Rick is giving him the cold shoulder, the man asks, "You despise me, don't you?" To which Rick responds, "If I gave you any thought, I suppose I would." It's a devastating response, because to him, the man wasn't even worth thinking about at all. Throughout the early 2000s, there was a particular man who believed he'd been seriously wronged, treated unfairly and unjustly by a certain group of people. Day after day, these perceived offenses continued eating away at him, and he constantly blamed others for everything wrong in his life, which had fallen into utter shambles. Ultimately, consumed by his rage, he decided to take revenge against anyone he believed had done him wrong. And it wasn't a short list. But by 2008, not a single one of his intended targets was even thinking about him. Some could barely even remember him. It had been so long ago, and he'd been so inconsequential. A blip on the radar. Like Humphrey Bogart, they didn't really think about him at all. Join me now as we examine the shocking story of a bona fide serial killer in Omaha, Nebraska. You'll learn how one man's obsession with perceived injustices and a burning desire for revenge led him down a dark and twisted path, culminating in a series of gruesome crimes that would haunt the city of Omaha for years to come. Anyone who's ever been to their local emergency room knows it's a pretty chaotic place. A bustling hub of activity. Anything from car accidents, heart attacks, severe burns and other injuries most of us associate with the ER. But something many people might not realize, emergency rooms are often where people with mental health emergencies are treated as well. Conditions like severe depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, or schizophrenia. ER professionals really do see it all. And sometimes, it can be downright bizarre. Like what doctors in Terre Haute, Indiana experienced one wintry day in January 2013. A man had just brought himself into the ER, and staff could tell right away he was in pretty bad shape. He wasn't bleeding or injured, but was stumbling drunk and at the cusp of a mental breakdown. His blood alcohol level was 3 times the legal limit, and he reported himself as suicidal, having just been fired from his job 3 days earlier for showing up drunk. Hospital staff evaluated and treated the man before eventually discharging him, but just 5 hours later, he was back again and even more intoxicated than before. So doctors started the process all over again, hooking him up to an IV and preparing a mental health assessment. But suddenly, the man ripped out his own IV and stumbled out the doors, discharging himself back into the world. Just 1 hour later, he'd wind up in the ER of another local hospital. Needless to say, it was a terrible day for the man, who was clearly battling some demons. Within 3 months, he'd be arrested for drunk driving his Ferrari outside Chicago. Within 7 months, he'd be arrested for much, much worse. But for the hospital doctors, cases like his were just all in a day's work. The hospital is a place where staff learn to expect the unexpected, and after a while, they've seen it all. One doctor who'd really seen it all was 65-year-old Roger Brumback of Omaha, Nebraska, the long-serving chair of the Department of Pathology at Creighton University School of Medicine. When it came to medicine, Dr. Brumback had been nothing short of a prodigy, beginning med school at Penn State by the age of 19, by far the youngest in his class. From there, his career had taken him all around the United States, becoming a recognized expert in neurology and pathology. For more than 40 years, Roger dedicated himself to his craft, authoring 19 books, publishing over 100 articles, and even founding 2 medical journals all on his own. In medical circles, Roger's tireless work ethic was the stuff of legends, but he was also known for being a pleasure to work with and to work for. In 2001, Roger took his position as the pathology department chair at Creighton, but by 2013, finally decided it was time for him to retire. So he and his wife Mary announced they'd be leaving Omaha to move to West Virginia to be closer to family. 65-year-old Mary Brumback had married Roger when he was still in med school, when they were both around 21 years old. Mary graduated university as a pharmacist, but eventually went on to become a lawyer. And throughout Roger's prolific career, Mary was always right beside him, helping him write, edit, and publish. Together, they were truly an example of what a couple can accomplish when their goals, values, and interests are aligned. But nothing they'd accomplished together made them more proud than their 3 children, Daryl, Owen, and Audrey, who were now grown up and had families of their own. Sunday, May 12, 2013 was Mother's Day. Roger and Mary had spent their day preparing for their upcoming move, packing a few things away and putting some fresh coats of paint on the walls. They had movers scheduled to arrive that week to take away large items like their piano, but all in all, the day was mostly relaxing. They spent a few hours FaceTiming with their children and grandchildren, who'd called to wish Mary the very best on her special day. Roger's final lecture at Creighton Medical was scheduled just 2 days later on May 14th. But when it came time for the lecture, Roger Brumback was nowhere to be found, leaving his colleagues extremely confused. Meanwhile, at the Brumback home in West Omaha, a moving team had arrived to take away the family piano. Walking up to the door, one of the movers rang the doorbell repeatedly, but received no answer. Eventually, he opened the unlocked door to see if anyone was home. But as he swung it open, he noticed that an ammunition clip from a handgun was lying on the floor. Immediately he knew something was terribly wrong and dialed 911, and police were dispatched to the location.
I got a check of well-being at 11421 Shirley Street, 11421 Shirley Street. See Jason, he'll be waiting in the driveway. Says he went there to get a piano from an elderly couple. The door was partially open. He yelled for him, got no response. Saw a gun clip laying close to the door. He exited and is now waiting for you.
Not knowing what she might find, an Omaha police officer arrived to perform the welfare check at the Brumback home. But as soon as she opened the front door, the smell of death was unmistakable. There, lying lifeless just inside the front door, was Roger Brumback. Not far away in the living room was the body of his wife, Mary. They'd been deceased since Mother's Day, about 48 hours earlier.
I'm going to need a squad here. I got 2 parties down inside. one white male, maybe 50, 60, and a female party. 79 to 70. Command 70.
Command 70, I'm clear.
Yeah, I'm going to need you here, please.
One of the detectives responding to the crime scene was Omaha Police Homicide veteran Derek Moyes. Once inside the home, Detective Moyes began observing the bloody scene around him. He saw the ammunition clip lying on the floor, the one the piano mover had noticed originally. He also noticed an empty shell casing, as well as a bullet hole in the door itself. Scattered around the floor, he found several more pieces from the same handgun, as if the gun had been smashed or broken. But gunshots alone didn't explain the excessive amount of blood covering the crime scene. It was on the walls, the floor, and the furniture all around the victims. Upon examining the bodies, it became clear that both victims had been violently and repeatedly stabbed in their necks. It also appeared that two separate kitchen knives had been used as the murder weapons, as a different knife was discovered near each of the victims' bodies. In addition to the fatal stabbing, Roger had been shot 3 times, but no bullets had been used on Mary. Instead, it became clear that she'd been struck in the head with an object, which might explain the broken pistol parts discovered on the floor. Further investigation ruled out robbery as a possible motive, as nothing appeared to have been stolen, even though the Brumbacks lived in a nice house in an affluent neighborhood with many valuable items in plain sight. The sheer brutality of it all indicated that the killer's motive had most likely been personal. As Detective Moyes searched the house, looking for more clues, he went into the kitchen and saw an open drawer with knives inside of it. Noticing the style of knives in the drawer, he realized the Brumbacks had been murdered with knives from their own kitchen. The detective's heart almost stopped. It suddenly hit him. He'd seen this all before. 2 victims in a nice neighborhood stabbed precisely in their jugular veins with knives taken from their own kitchens. He remembered those exact details from a case he'd worked on 5 years earlier in the Omaha suburb of Dundee. A brutal double homicide that had never been solved, and it was one that continued to haunt him. Was it possible the same killer had struck again? Just a few minutes later, while still at the Brumbacks house, Detective Moyes and his team were informed about Roger's position at the pathology department at Creighton. With this information, they knew it had to be more than just a mere coincidence, because the house that had been attacked 5 years earlier in Dundee had also been the home of a Creighton doctor of pathology. It was deja vu all over again, like some twisted time capsule, giving the detective a second chance to catch what now appeared to be a serial killer on the loose in Omaha. And it didn't take long for the media to make that connection either.
Having pets means you're constantly playing detective, always coming home to another mystery to solve. Well, for us most recently, it was trying to figure out which of our 3 dogs had figured out how to open the cupboard to pull the garbage out and scatter it all over the floor. Well, one day, it appeared the culprit had thrown caution to the wind and decided to make another brave attempt. This time, while I was at home, and I was shocked by who it was. It was Meatball, the smallest of the 3, and apparently the smartest. Meatball was the mastermind. He discovered that by continuously slapping the cupboard door with his paw, it would eventually bounce open. Now, while it was a hilarious mystery to solve at the time, it could have ended badly. It could have ended with an unexpected and costly vet bill if he'd swallowed something from the garbage that he shouldn't have. And although accidents and illnesses aren't always things that can be avoided, unexpected vet bills that can break the bank are. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years and has helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are. because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/madness. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/madness. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/madness. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Now, still no answers for the father or for the family of Dr. Roger Brumback. His wife, Mary.
A piano mover discovered the couple dead inside their home near 114th and Shirley Tuesday morning. Police are being tight-lipped, but they did say today their cold case unit is investigating this homicide's similarities to another double murder in 2008.
Back on March 13th, 2008, Detective Moyes had been called to the Dundee, Nebraska home of Creighton pathologist Dr. William Hunter. His wife, Claire Hunter, was also a doctor at Creighton, but was away in Hawaii that week to attend a conference. That evening, Dr. Hunter arrived home from work just before 6 p.m. He was surprised to see his house cleaner, 57-year-old Shirley Sherman's vehicle, still parked in the driveway. It wasn't like her to be still working so late. Not long after walking through his door, the doctor discovered Shirley's lifeless body lying on the floor in his hallway, a knife taken from his own kitchen was still lodged in her neck. As a medical expert, he only needed one look to determine she was deceased. 15 feet away on the floor in the dining room lay his 11-year-old son, Thomas, murdered in the same manner as Shirley. The detectives assigned to the case, including Detective Moyes, worked tirelessly to track down the killer. But whoever it was, had been very careful not to leave any traces behind in the house. No DNA, no fingerprints, no nothing.
And all were brutal, horrific homicides, using knives, and the knives left in the two 2008 victims' necks, like through and through. It was impossible. Like, I didn't even know if I'd be able to look at the autopsy photos, because it's like, it was that type of brutality.
That was Bob Mata, a criminal defense attorney turned podcaster. He hosts the show Defense Diaries and just happens to be a friend of mine. So before I go to record every episode, I read the script a few times, and then I go to YouTube to see if there's any videos or documentaries I can watch to make sure I get the names pronounced correctly. And I'm scrolling through the thumbnails on YouTube, and I see a very familiar face, and I'm thinking, hey, I know that guy. And as it turned out, Bob was the defense lawyer for the person who would eventually be put on trial for these murders. So I knew I had to reach out to him.
When you look at the violence that occurred at both of these crime scenes and the fact that knives were used, for there not to be any semblance of any kind of forensic DNA, fingerprints, anything, it's unsettling.
Outside the house, however, was a different story, as several witnesses came forward with reports of seeing a mysterious man in the area on the day of the murder. He'd seemed a little lost while driving around the neighborhood in his silver Honda CRV. Witnesses described the man who emerged from the vehicle as somewhat heavyset, with olive-colored skin, wearing business attire. One neighbor recalled seeing him stumble as if he'd been drinking as he walked along the sidewalk right up to the Hunter's home. One last piece of valuable information came from a witness who noticed the Honda's license plate. She hadn't taken down the number, but remembered it was definitely from out of state, and described the license plate image as a pastel-colored sunset. With very little to go on, detectives began exploring a number of theories, all of them centered around possible motives. One theory revolved around 11-year-old Thomas. Detectives learned that Thomas frequently used an online chat room specifically for preteens called Yville. When detectives dove a little bit deeper into Thomas's Yville interactions, they discovered he often pretended to be an older teenager. They also learned that more than a few of the people Thomas had been chatting with were doing the opposite and pretending to be much younger than they actually were. Definitely sketchy. Detectives believed it was possible Thomas had become the victim of an online predator. Another theory for the murders revolved around the other victim, the house cleaner Shirley Sherman. The 57-year-old had been a lifelong resident of Omaha and had been a local house cleaner for more than 30 years, known for her great work, reliability, and pleasant personality. When detectives looked closer at Shirley, they learned there'd been some conflict in her personal life regarding her adult daughter's boyfriend. The man her daughter had been seeing was actually a married man, and according to her daughter, he was excessively violent, even breaking her jaw at one point. It was revealed that Shirley had been attempting to convince her daughter to leave the man, and on more than one occasion had confronted the boyfriend directly. After her murder, Shirley's family suggested to detectives they might want to look into the abusive boyfriend. Ultimately, the man had a solid alibi, and before long, police crossed him off their potential suspect list entirely. A third major theory detectives had pursued was the possibility that Shirley and Thomas hadn't been the intended victims. What if the killer had been looking for Dr. William or Dr. Claire Hunter? Perhaps it was a former patient or colleague holding a grudge. But when detectives asked Dr. Hunter if he knew anyone who'd want to harm him, he couldn't think of a single person.
Do you have any idea who or why somebody would do something like this?
Honestly, I've been just racking my brain. I mean, these are like peaceful existence, almost ridiculously simple.
Although Dr. Hunter couldn't imagine anyone associated with Creighton wishing to do him harm, it was still a lead detective's pursuit. The number of patients who might hold a grudge against a doctor was potentially endless. The only seemingly solid lead they found was a former Russian doctor who they discovered had some serious beef with the pathology department, even threatening to sue the university. However, after some rather extensive investigation into that suspect, the lead never panned out. Because the double homicide in Dundee had become such a high-profile case, the FBI offered to create a psychological profile of the killer. The FBI's best guess was that Thomas and Shirley had been the victim of a serial killer. The precise knife wounds on their necks suggested an experienced killer who knew exactly where to strike. But as for who the killer might be, they believed it was possibly some sort of transient drifter. They also believed it might be impossible to find the murderer until they struck again. Eventually, Thomas and Shirley's murders became an official cold case with the Omaha Police Department. But all that changed in 2013 when Roger and Mary Brumback were found murdered 5 years later under incredibly similar circumstances. It appeared that the FBI may have been right all along, that this was the work of a serial killer targeting victims with connections to the Creighton Pathology Department. In the days following the Brumback murders, the connection with Creighton became even more clear when another Creighton pathologist named Dr. Chandra Boutra came forward with a chilling story.
On Mother's Day, she was out to a brunch with her husband, and her ADP alarm went off. So they got a notification that their alarm at the house had triggered. She didn't even call the cops at that point. They got back home. They thought it was this back door that had blown open on several occasions in the past, and they didn't really think anything of it until sometime later after the Brumbecks are killed and people in the department are like, hey, you know, did you ever call the police about, you know, this thing that happened in your house with this your basement door being opened? She's like, no. And then she decides that I should.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, like an apartment that's within your budget, but then you got an upstairs neighbor who blasts the stereo all the time, or going to the supermarket that's always out of everything, but you always go there because it's close by. But when it comes to your health, there is no compromise. So don't go back to that one doctor who uses your appointment to stare at his phone just because they're available right now or they take your slightly sketchy insurance. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable, listen to you, and prioritize your health. And you can search by location, availability, and insurance. So literally, no compromises here, because with ZocDoc, you've got more options than you know. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. And these doctors all have verified reviews from actual real patients. So check out ZocDoc. We're talking about your health here. You deserve it. Go to ZocDoc.com/madness and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/madness. ZocDoc.com/madness. Dr. Boutra became convinced that someone had tried to break into her home on the same day the Brumbacks had been murdered. Under the circumstances, it was easy to imagine that Dr. Boutra had narrowly avoided becoming a victim herself. Suddenly, the disgruntled colleague theory seemed like the best place for police to begin their new investigation. The only thing that didn't seem to fit was the FBI's characterization of a killer as being some sort of drifter. It's just not how any doctor would imagine describing a former colleague. A week after the Brumback murders, the Omaha chief of police announced the formation of a task force to the press.
Today is the first day I've elected to make public comments on behalf of the Omaha Police Department on the Brumback investigation. Since May 14th, the Omaha community has understandably been on edge, in mourning, and a whole host of questions have opened up, namely, who committed the homicides of Dr. and Mrs. Brumback, and are the homicides in any way related to the 2008 homicides of Shirley Sherman and Thomas Hunter in the Dundee section of our city. To make the strongest push possible towards solving these homicides and to determine if the 2008 homicides are related to our recent homicides, I've ordered the formation of a task force. This specialized task force has been and will be operating 7 days a week with the sole purpose of solving the four homicides that I have mentioned. I will say this, I would not want this task force coming after me if I was the killer or killers.
With the new task force dedicating enormous amounts of resources and efforts, detectives pulled all the personal records from the Creighton Pathology Department, going all the way back to 2000, when Drs. Brumback and Hunter had first begun working there. Hundreds and hundreds of dossiers were created on every single person who'd ever worked in the department. Yes, it was indeed a needle in a haystack, but this time, detectives believed they were at least looking in the right haystack. And it just so happened that the dossier of a former employee named Anthony Garcia landed on Detective Moy's desk. Born in California in 1973, Anthony Garcia had graduated from the University of Utah School of Medicine in 1999. After med school, Anthony began his residency at a hospital in Albany, New York. Residencies typically take around 4 years to complete, but Anthony only lasted 8 months in Albany before resigning, after a pattern of poor job performance and a terrible attitude had emerged. After leaving Albany, Anthony applied for a pathology residency at Creighton. However, he never informed them about his previous job in Albany. If they'd known, he never would have been accepted. Coincidentally, when Anthony arrived in Omaha in 2000, The director of the pathology residency program was Dr. William Hunter. The chair of the entire department was Roger Brumback. Anthony's time at Creighton didn't go much better than his previous residency at Albany. He was rude, made unforgivable mistakes, lacked basic required knowledge, and had a terrible attitude towards his patients and superiors. And the doctor who evaluated him most harshly was Dr. Chandra Bhutra, who regularly handed in official evaluations, noting Anthony's poor performance. Eventually, Anthony was fired before he'd even completed his first year at Creighton. As Detective Moyes looked through Anthony's personnel file, he quickly noticed that both Dr. Hunter and Dr. Brumback had signed Anthony's official termination letter. By some miracle, Anthony was then granted yet another residency at a hospital in Chicago. But again, things didn't go much better. Over the next 2 years, Anthony slipped into severe mental decline, becoming severely depressed, suffering terrible migraines, and racking up tens of thousands of dollars in his own medical debt to treat it. He also began abusing alcohol and writing his own prescriptions. With his condition eventually getting so bad, he underwent electroshock therapy in 2003, and he never finished his residency. Anthony eventually moved back home with his parents in California, declared bankruptcy, and found new work repairing cars. For a while, Anthony completely forgot about trying to become a doctor, and all the doctors in Omaha had completely forgotten about him. It wasn't until 2007 when Anthony decided to try his hand in the medical field once more. This time, he was accepted to a residency at Louisiana State University, but within a few short months, they discovered he'd lied on his application. On the application, Anthony claimed he'd successfully completed a year at Creighton, but when the medical board double-checked his qualifications, Creighton informed them of the truth. He hadn't. Because of this, on February 28, 2008, Anthony was officially denied his license to practice medicine in Louisiana. 16 days later, Thomas Hunter and Shirley Sherman were murdered at the Dundee home of one of the doctors who'd fired him all those years ago. As Detective Moyes learned more and more about Anthony Garcia, the more he became convinced he was now looking at their prime suspect. Not only did Anthony possess a motive for the killings, the timing of the Dundee murders seemed like a giant smoking gun. Looking even deeper into Anthony, Moyes was able to track down the vehicle Anthony had been using in 2008, and when he saw the results, he couldn't believe his eyes. The vehicle registered to Anthony had been a silver Honda CR-V. The exact same make, model, and color reported by eyewitnesses at the crime scene. The car also had out-of-state Louisiana license plates, which featured an image of a pastel-colored sunset. Again, another perfect match. Anthony also matched the physical characteristics witnesses had described, a rotund man with olive-colored skin. Everything was starting to click into place. In the 5 years after the Dundee murders, the life and medical career of Anthony Garcia continued to decline. He moved back to Illinois, the only state he was still legally allowed to practice medicine. He found part-time gigs with small clinics, and at one point, took a job at an Indiana state penitentiary on a temporary license. But just like before, as soon as the Indiana Medical Board found out about his real credentials and history, he was denied a full license, this time in December 2012. Days later, Anthony was fired from one of his other jobs because he'd shown up to work intoxicated. 3 days after that was the infamous day he'd checked himself into a local emergency room with a blood alcohol level 3 times the legal limit, telling the doctors he had suicidal thoughts, only to come back hours later, even more drunk than before. 5 months later, Roger and Mary Brumback were murdered in Omaha. Detective Moyes and his team spent 6 weeks investigating Anthony Garcia, learning absolutely everything they could about the man who was now their primary suspect. And everything added up, including the fact that both double homicides had occurred shortly after Anthony had been denied medical licenses, once in 2008 and again in 2013. Detectives were also able to verify that just 2 months before the Brumback murders, Anthony had purchased the exact same model of handgun discovered in pieces at the crime scene. But the real breakthrough came when detectives were able to positively place Anthony near the crime scene, something authorities weren't able to do with their previous suspect.
There was a guy, a Russian guy, this Michael Belenky, who had all of the same issues, who was actually their suspect for years, but they just couldn't place him in Omaha. Like, everything was identical to Garcia, you know, had left, was fired, had issues with doctors in there. Women were afraid to be around him in there. You know, it's like this whole thing with Belenky was identical to Garcia. It was the exact same story that they used for Garcia. They could have slipped Belenky's name in there and it would have been the exact same theory of the case.
On the day of the Brumback murders in 2013, a single incoming phone call had been made to Anthony's cell phone. He never answered it. But after examining cell tower records, they were able to place him near Omaha at the time of the murders, despite the fact that his home in Terre Haute, Indiana, was a 9-hour drive away. A credit card purchase from a Wings restaurant also placed Anthony in Omaha that day, just minutes away from the Brumback house. The decision to arrest Anthony Garcia wasn't made lightly. Police didn't want to make an arrest before they believed they'd secured enough evidence for a conviction. However, they were also now firmly convinced that Anthony was a serial killer, getting revenge on his colleagues he believed had wronged him. And since the potential list of victims was rather long, they believed it was only a matter of time before he'd kill again. So on July 15th, 2013, the decision was made to have Anthony arrested, but he wasn't at home. Instead, he was in his car, heading south to Louisiana. When Anthony was pulled over by state troopers in southern Illinois, they realized the decision to arrest him had been made just in time to prevent another homicide. Not only was Anthony driving with a blood alcohol level twice the legal limit at 6:30 in the morning, inside his car, they found what was essentially a kill kit, a handgun with 50 rounds of ammunition, as well as a brand new crowbar and sledgehammer, along with a set of handwritten directions to the hospital he'd been fired from in Louisiana. He'd also taken a box of rubber gloves, a stethoscope, as well as an official white LSU logoed lab coat. Detectives believed that Anthony had brought along all these items to use as a disguise that would let him get close to the victims he intended to kill. Outside of his kill kit and disguise, Anthony hadn't packed a single piece of luggage for his trip.
When he was arrested, his family, namely his brother Fernando, had gone online, and I end up getting a call about 1 a.m, and he left me a message saying, "Hey, my brother got picked up in Southern Illinois on a DUI. And I'm like, "A DUI?" And I was going to call him and tell him, "Hey, you know, I couldn't possibly drive down for a DUI. You just need to find a local guy down there." So I do call him. He answers. All he tells me is, "It sounds like a murder case." So I wake Allison up and I'm like, "It sounds like we might have picked up a murder case in Southern Illinois." And so her and I jump in the vehicle and we take the drive. So then we find out, you know, in the probable cause affidavit in that case was very much like the Idaho 4 case with Koberger, very detailed. So we start reading this story, the state's narrative, this, you know, this revenge theme that this guy had gone to Creighton University and their medical school, and he was in the residency program in 2001. He was fired, and that he held this grudge, and that 7 years later goes and kills the 11-year-old Thomas Hunter and the housekeeper, and then 5 years later goes and kills Roger and Mary Brumback. This guy was like theoretically a serial killer. that's what they were alleging he was. So immediately I tell Alice, I'm like, we had to call my father.
As far as defense lawyers go, very few are fortunate to have a father like Robert Mata, a man with a specific kind of high-profile trial experience Bob would certainly need if he decided to take this case.
Now, my dad was, as you know, Tyler, was John Wayne Gacy's lawyer back in 1978 through 80. They got a lot of hate. He's like, if you ever get a big murder case, you know, bring me on and we'll try it together. You know, so it was me, my wife, Allison, who's a pit bull, brilliant attorney, and my father, who's also a brilliant attorney. And we tried Garcia because at that point we hadn't even tried a murder case. We tried tons and tons of trials. But for us, it was a big leap. In terms of being a trial attorney, you're either experienced or you're not. What Anthony was telling us from the minute that we met him is that he didn't do these things, that he was innocent of the crimes.
Despite Anthony's insistence to the contrary, however, detectives soon began uncovering even more evidence against him. After being arrested and taken into custody, a subsequent search warrant for Anthony's home in Indiana revealed the depths to which he'd fallen. Most of the rooms were bare. His bed was an air mattress. Empty beer cans littered the floor, and the only real food inside the house was a box of cereal he kept inside the refrigerator. Suddenly, the FBI's profile of a vagabond drifter didn't seem too far off. As far as doctors go, Anthony Garcia was about as close as one could get. On his dining room table and in his kitchen sink, detectives discovered stacks of damning paperwork. It turned out Anthony had kept a record of almost every single perceived injustice against him. He had copies of his negative performance evaluations throughout his career, along with his termination letter from Creighton, as well as several rejection letters from state licensing boards. It was clear this was a man completely fixated on holding a grudge. Police also found numerous handwritten pages detailing plans to commit identity fraud, kidnappings, tortures, and other murders. Now that police had access to his cell phone, examinations of his metadata and internet history revealed even more sinister plans. Among his internet searches, Anthony had looked up the personal addresses for several other people he blamed for his professional downfall, including a doctor in Albany as well as one in Chicago. But the most surprising revelation from Anthony's cell phone data was that Roger Brumback had apparently not been on Anthony's intended victim list in 2013. Instead, the records showed Dr. Chandra Boutra had been the one he'd initially traveled to Nebraska to kill. In fact, he hadn't looked up Roger's home address until he'd failed to break into the Boutra's house that day. It was only after his failed attempt, while sitting in the parking lot of a barbecue wing restaurant, that he'd searched for Roger's address and easily found it in the white pages. And although these pieces of evidence would be introduced at trial, defense attorney Bob Mata seriously challenged the veracity of the state's claims.
The Google searches they claim that happened, which frankly were probably the most damning thing. They said that they had found on his tablet that he had Googled Boutra, and then he had Googled the Brumbacks for their addresses. And, you know, the problem was that what they did is that one of the cops had extracted it to his own personal phone, an old phone of his. And what they kept all the data on was a WordPad document. So at trial, which, you know, if you don't know what WordPad is, like, it's like a Word document, except it's the basic version of it. So at trial, what we did is we actually brought up where they're claiming the information about these searches was, and we typed in not guilty.
Well, it's not proof of any deliberate malfeasance. Keeping records of evidence on an easily editable WordPad document certainly seems a bit strange, if not irresponsible, in what would become a capital murder case. It would take 3 long years before Anthony Garcia was put on trial for the 4 murders in Omaha. If convicted, the state would seek the death penalty. During this time, however, it became obvious that Anthony's mental health was in serious decline.
just so I want people to have a clear understanding that Anthony Garcia was kept in solitary for 3 years, 23 hours a day. He got 1 hour a day out of his cell. He lost his mind in there. When I'm saying 23 hours a day, I mean every bit of that. And they tortured him in there. And I'm not talking about physically, I'm talking about psychologically. They wouldn't let him sleep. You know, because in cases like that, in cases where you've got a child victim and it's a case that has affected a community, trust me when I tell you this, jail and prison guards don't give a shit about the presumption of innocence. That's not something that they care about. They viewed him as a child killer, and they acted as such. And like he was telling us repeatedly that they were torturing him in there psychologically. You know, he claimed that they had raped him. So we were trying to address it. We were trying to get him out of solitary, you know. So we challenged our own client's competency 3 times because within 6 months, he just wasn't there, like mentally. He was like he couldn't help in his own defense. Like he could not assist us. We couldn't have any kind of conversation with them because all he could focus on was the fact that they were torturing him in there. And we're trying to help him. We wanted to get him to Lincoln Regional Mental Hospital to get him evaluated and really just to get him out of the jail. And so the first time that we did it, we saw improvement from him mentally, you know, like he did. He kind of came back a little bit. But then once they put him back in, they found him competent.
Despite being evaluated and declared mentally competent to stand trial, Anthony was no longer even speaking to his attorneys by the time they got to trial.
I mean, Tyler, I sat there in a 5-week jury trial and our client didn't say one word to any of us.
To onlookers, it appeared as if he wasn't even aware of a trial going on around him.
They were wheeling him in and he slept through his trial. Like he had his hands like across his chest like a vampire would in its casket and was just kind of like drifting off. Now you can imagine what that would have looked like to a jury. You know, it looked like this guy doesn't give a shit. This guy doesn't care. He's clearly guilty, you know, and that's how it appeared to them. And we weren't allowed to explain to them why he appeared that way in front of the jury. We couldn't tell the jury why he was like this.
It wasn't until after the trial that Bob would discover the real reasons for Anthony's appearance and demeanor during the trial.
Somebody recognized that I was one of Garcia's attorneys and they emailed us. And it turned out that he was the nurse at the jail, Douglas County Jail, and he told us in an email that he was the one that was administering a shot to him before, like every court hearing and throughout the trial, knocking him out. They were tranquilizing him, which is shocking. You know, it really is. I found it to be stunning that the state would do that, to have him appear that way.
In addition to Anthony's shocking behavior during trial, the state was able to put together a very powerful circumstantial case against him with evidence they collected.
In Garcia's case, they had a hell of a narrative. You know, they really did. Like their narrative was super compelling. They flesh out their narrative. And like the one thing that I'm always trying to impress upon people, Tyler, is that the state wasn't there when the crimes were committed. We weren't there when the crimes were committed. Law enforcement was not there when the crimes were committed. The state has a theory of a case. We have a theory of a case. And ultimately, what it boils down to, and both of us are coming to our own theories based on the same evidence that law enforcement collected. And that's all it is.
In the end, after 5 weeks of testimony, the jury considered the evidence against Anthony to be overwhelming. And after 7.5 hours of deliberation, the jury returned its guilty verdict. There in the courtroom watching the verdict was the Omaha chief of police who'd put together the task force in wake of the Brumback murders.
I'll just say one thing. I was confident all along that the citizens of Douglas County and Omaha who comprise this jury would sift through the evidence, would sift through the theatrics and come to the right verdict. And they did. And moving forward, you know, let's remember the victims. And there really isn't any reason to mention or worry about Anthony Garcia any further. Thank you.
In comments given to the Omaha World Herald, Claire Hunter, the mother of Thomas, was quoted as saying, "Garcia was a guy who my husband didn't hire, didn't say a word when they fired him, and he comes back 7 years later and kills our son? That's not a normal response, not even to anger. That's not revenge. What he did to those four people is animal. Defense lawyer Bob Mata has since stepped away from the courtroom and into the sound booth, where he hosts his own podcast, Defense Diaries. The first season covers his father's infamous John Wayne Gacy case and reveals hours upon hours of never-heard-before recordings between his father and John Wayne Gacy. But in his second season, called Tunnel Vision, it takes a deep dive into the case we've been discussing today.
It is a very, very deep, dark story that's probably worth listening. And it's one of those things where when I started this season, you know, people were like, well, how are you going to talk about the case? Well, our client never said anything that would trigger privilege because all he always maintained is innocence. I'm not going to sugarcoat this and make this some kind of defense lawyer. Oh, look, he's innocent. You know, I'm on my soapbox. He's innocent. I'm going to lay out all the facts for the first time the same way that I was hoping that a jury would look at it and hope that they'll come to their own conclusions once they hear both sides of it. So my listeners are our jury, and I'm putting out all of the state's evidence.
Of course, we asked Bob what he felt some of the more compelling pieces of evidence were that might point to Anthony, perhaps, having been wrongfully convicted.
We didn't know what day that the Brumbecks were killed. The state's theory was that it had to be Mother's Day. So it was always our feeling that the Brumbecks were not killed between 3 and 4 in the afternoon on Mother's Day, because we're talking about a bedroom community in Omaha on Mother's Day. It was a beautiful day. It was like a 71 degree day, a Sunday. You're outside grilling, you're cooking, your mom's over. So we start canvassing the neighborhood. And remember, there were 5 gunshots that all happened from outside. The intruder was outside of the house shooting into the house with a 9mm, and no one heard it. Not one person in that neighborhood heard it. And if you've ever heard a 9mm, it's implausible that no one would have heard those gunshots, including the next door neighbor was an Omaha cop who was home, and he didn't hear anything. He didn't hear the gunshots. And we found somebody who heard around midnight what he called, he said it sounded like 3 to 4 fireworks, sound like big bangs. So our theory was that the Brumbecks weren't killed at that time. Like, it was impossible. There's no way that no one would have heard that nightmare that was going on in that house. It was completely implausible.
But Bob just didn't rely on his gut instincts and intuition to develop this theory. In fact, he believes the Mother's Day time of death can be refuted by hard facts.
We had hired Werner Spitz, who was the, you know, at the time, he's probably the most preeminent forensic pathologist on the planet. When he looks at the autopsy, what the autopsy says is that Roger Brumbeck was still in rigor mortis, and they don't get Brumbeck back to the morgue until that night, which we're talking like over 50 hours. And so when Spitz looks at it, he's like, there's no way physiologically, unless he was kept in a freezer for the days after he was killed, that he would still be in rigor mortis. It's scientifically impossible. So when I had Werner Spitz tell me that, I'm like, I don't think Garcia did it. I mean, like, I'm just looking at the science of it. It's like, we put on a good defense, you know, so there could be that element of me drinking the Kool-Aid, you know, or just buying our own defense. But like, it's hard to dispute science. You know, like, there's no rational explanation of how Brumbeck would still be in rigor mortis.
Just before trial, however, Bob received a shocking blow to his defense when it was revealed that Werner Spitz wouldn't be able to testify at trial.
He was our star witness. And then two weeks before the trial is supposed to start, the JonBenet Ramsey special comes out and Spitz is on it. And that's when he just flat out says that her brother did it. And he said what he did it with. It was like a lamp with like a square base. He's like, he took it and he crushed her skull with it like this. He crushed, you know, he's like, it fits perfectly into the skull where the skull was fractured. You know, so then Spitz gets sued immediately by her brother like the next day. So like, I'm then getting phone calls from his civil attorney because he sued him for $200 million. So like his civil attorney's like, I can't have him testify. I'm like, what are you kidding me? I'm like, this is a death penalty case. So we end up losing Spitz 2 weeks before trial. He subs in a guy who had the same scientific opinion, but he's not Werner Spitz. He's not the guy who worked on Kennedy's, you know, autopsy for the Warren Commission and every other big case that's been out there in the last 40 years. So it was one thing after another, man. It was a tough case, dude. It was a tough case, but it makes for an amazing podcast. I'll tell you that.
Like with all aspects of any true crime case, there are always two sides to the story. And it was Bob's job to give Anthony Garcia the best defense possible. To counter Bob's Mother's Day timeline, the prosecution offered multiple witnesses who testified the Brumbacks were found still wearing the exact same clothing they'd been seen wearing earlier that day. If you're interested in hearing more about this case, Season 2 of The Defense Diaries includes 50 episodes with Bob Mata laying out the entire case.
I lay out the entire case of the state, and I'm still not done with Garcia. So, like, we haven't even gotten to trial yet. It's very thorough. Like, I go through all the evidence. I talk about the alternate suspects. You know, so listen to it and make your own decision. Because I'm not trying to convince anybody. Believe me that, like, I call things as I see them. If I think things that were done improperly, obviously I'm talking about that. But it's not going to innocence or guilt. That's going to how the case was tried. You know, like, I mean, there were issues between us and the state. It was a hard fought case. So, like, I honestly sit here and I mean, do I see a world in which he could have done it? Yeah, I do. Do I see a world in which he may not have done it? Yeah, I do. You know, but that's based on the evidence. You know what I mean? And just lack thereof. So it's a tough case, man. You know, and right now, as it stands, I've got a client that I represented that's sitting on death row. So it's, you know, it's a tough thing for me. I don't know as I sit here now if justice was served. You know, I mean, if he's the guy, then he's exactly where he should be. You know, I mean, I can say that. But as I sit here now, I honestly don't know the answer, man. And I was as close to the case as you can get.
By the time of his sentencing, 2 years later, Anthony was barely recognizable. He'd put on considerable weight, and it appeared he hadn't shaved his beard since trial. He was escorted into the courtroom in a wheelchair, and he looked near catatonic with his eyes closed, showing no reaction as the judge sentenced him to death. Standing up to speak on the victim's behalf was Shirley Sherman's son, Jeff.
Mr. Garcia doesn't deserve my forgiveness. Doesn't deserve nothing for my family, for anybody. All the innocent victims that were taken. For what? For a job? Who does that? I'm left with constant images from courtroom photos of my mom laying there in a pool of her own blood with an 8-inch butcher knife hanging out her neck. I can't get those images ever out of my head. There's a special place for people like this, and I hope he ends up there. Thank you, Mr. Sherman.
Victim Thomas Hunter would have been 22 years old at the time of the sentencing, and it's easy to imagine that the academically gifted child might have followed in his parents' footsteps, perhaps even becoming a doctor himself. Today, a life-size bronze statue of Thomas sits on the lawn outside Creighton Medical Center. The image is an eternally young boy playing in nature. At the statue's dedication ceremony, Dr. Hunter stated the statue captured Thomas's essence as well as his spirit. The chairman of Creighton's Department of Medicine told the small crowd gathered that Thomas's life had been like a meteor. Though their existence may be brief, they light up the entire sky.
If you like deep dives, were your thing. If you're a one-offer, we might not be your thing, because they are definitely deep dives. And obviously, I'm trying to teach people about the law, you know, and the criminal justice system. But I try to do it in an interesting way so it's not dry and boring. Most of our fans, I think, really appreciate it. And then we also have the docket, and I brought on my badass wife, who's just a pit bull of a defense attorney, brilliant woman, and she is my co-host on the docket. So check the pod out. The name of it is Defense Diaries. You can find it anywhere you can find your pods. And also check out our YouTube channel, which is Defense Diaries Podcast. We have a ton of content on there as well. We're always deep diving. I'm always trying to give you the lawyer's perspective. So we look forward to you guys listening, and hopefully you'll join the community. We'd love to have you.
Follow the Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. To support the show and get access to ad-free episodes, extra content, and Patreon-exclusive episodes, go to patreon.com/madnesspod. To find us on Instagram and Facebook, search The Minds of Madness, and on Twitter using the handle @madnesspod. And also, by checking out our sponsors and using our promo codes, you're also helping support the show. We've got all the links in our episode notes. So until next week, thanks for listening.